Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 115. I'm Tom Merritt. Scott Johnson on vacation, but I'm very happy to be joined by Mr. Brian Ibbett, host of Coverville.
That's right. I'm the Joan Rivers to Scott Johnson's Johnny Carson.
Thank you. Thank you, Joan, for joining us. Of course, you know him and love him from Coverville. He also co-hosts The Morning Stream with Scott Johnson and Film Sack. All over the Frog Pants Network. So, Brian, thanks for filling in, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an honor, actually, to be on this side of the microphone for this, because I've been on, I was actually on one of the first dozen, I can't remember which episode it was, but I was really early on in Forecast. So
early audio-only days.
That's right, yes. Yeah. They couldn't see me scrambling to to figure out what my 50-year forecast was going to be.
Also, joining us, we've got some great guests today, Father Robert Ballester in the studio. Thanks for coming up.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be back in sunny Petaluma.
And the techstop.net is the place to find you. You have to put the right?
The. That's got to be the.
So lots of good gadget coverage there. And also Norman Chan, editor at tested.com. And it also says here, lover of Pocky, technology, design, music, movies, and comics.
Oh, you're just reading that off Twitter.
I actually probably was cut and pasted off Twitter into the document that I'm reading. Yeah.
All those accurate. Pocky number one.
Excellent.
Oh, who doesn't love Pocky?
It is Pocky playoffs, right? Oh, that's hockey. but tested.com, a great place to go. It's because you guys are now teamed up with the Mythbusters.
Yeah, Jamie Hyman and Adam Savage. We're their official home on the internet. It's a recent transition. Those guys are great. They've been posting some stuff on the site. And we've kind of transitioned from a technology-only site to a technology, art design, maker culture, science site.
Well, congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I love what you guys do over there. Let's kick off with a prediction from one of our listeners. Jonathan wrote in, said, I just listened to episode 114, and Tom's question about who would rule the first space colony got me thinking. I'd have to say Google would be the first. All it takes is someone inventing a super high-speed method for transmitting data from satellites to the moon. The moon is cold, and that makes it a perfect place for Google server farms that can run the servers harder and have almost no cooling costs.
So a tech person, IT person, was definitely contributing to this. Jonathan is definitely in the IT department and has to deal with those meat locker IT closets that all the servers run in. Very good.
Good on the cooling, but what about the lag? Norman, do you have any?
Yeah, I don't know if that's server farm on the moon. I mean, and how would you get power there? I mean, there was that whole Dyson Sphere post that went up last week and on building. I mean, I guess you can CNC the facilities there, send a rocket up, very low cost, and use the materials already on the moon. I don't know if it'd be good for Google servers. Yeah, you're right about the lag.
Yeah, the lag and the energy. You could put it in permanent sunlight, I suppose, but that's only going to get you so far.
I love the idea. It's super geeky, but there are a couple of problems. The first is, it's actually a misconception that things are really, really cold in space. In fact, there's much more energy spent on, say, the International Space Station in keeping things cool than warming them up. That's because without any atmosphere, you don't get heat convection away from heat sources. And so if you set up servers on the moon, you would need something like a heat pump to drive the heat away from the devices into the lunar surface. It wouldn't just naturally freeze. As far as power is concerned, well, I mean, if you set up a couple of solar panels on the light side of the moon, you're all good.
Yeah, you do have permanent sunlight. That's true. I didn't realize that about the heat dissipation, though.
And as far as lag, well, I mean, this is going to be happening in 20, 30, 40 years where we develop communications with tachyons, which are particles that travel almost backwards in time. So, I mean, the lag will be negligible.
Well, that's good. So we fixed that.
Yeah, as long as I can run my gaming server, I'm good to go.
But even if they don't put the servers up there, Google probably does conquer the moon, right?
Haven't they already?
I mean, it's self-driving cars, it's Google glasses, it's Google rockets, it's Google space colonies. Logical.
They still haven't solved the cow problem, though. Getting cows onto the moon.
Well, the cow jumps
until they
over
do
the
that.
Moon,
yes, right. Exactly. Until they do that, it's a no go.
I don't know that that we've solved anything here, Jonathan, but I appreciate you sending us the email. Good stuff. Folks, you can send us your predictions. Email them to forecast@twit.tv or post them up at the blog, forecastpodcast.com. Real quickly, before we get into the main predicting, I want to thank our sponsor, Netflix, streaming you thousands of TV episodes and movies. I was just watching Quantum Leap this weekend. In preparation for Autopilot, lots of easy ways to access streaming movies and TV shows. You can watch Netflix movies on your Mac, your PC, your iPad. I was just reading a story that I think it's close to 20% of the connected TVs are Xboxes or PS3s. There's some kind of game console, and then Netflix is on there too. In fact, Netflix is the driving force between people connecting their TVs. So if you want to sign up for free, for 30 days, go to netflix.com/twit, or if you're already a subscriber, pass that URL around for folks to try it out. netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Let's get into the predicting. Norman Chan, we'll start with you. What predictions do you have to lay on us today?
All right. I think, I don't want to make the Facebook, Instagram joke. I think in 100 years, we're going to have computing power, enough computing power to create these really intricate and detailed, realistic, self-contained simulations like we do right now. So scientists right now, they use computers to simulate weather, for example. But I think in 100 years, we'll have, you know, whether it's quantum computers or any other type of really high, fast computer processor, realistic simulations, not unlike The Sims. And we'll also have the graphics power to visualize these simulations. So, for example, like The Sims or a Populous or a black and white game. But one interesting byproduct of this is that directors, film directors, are going to go into these simulations and shoot movies in them. And it'll be kind of like voyeuristic. So you can imagine like that Twilight Zone episode with the little people or the Simpsons parody of that. Mm. They'll be, you know, completely procedurally generated. They'll grow at an unbelievable rate. And then we'll go into them and shoot documentaries inside them.
So, how long before we have the first reality show based on virtual characters?
Yeah, why not? I mean,
the first Sims where they're voting each other off the island.
Exactly. Like right now with The Sims 3, a lot of the behavior of those characters are procedurally generated, but a lot of the narrative we imbue on the characters, you know, with screenshots or machinima. I think the unpredictability of a computer simulation is going to lend itself to interesting narratives. And I think there will be a lot of public outcry. People are going to talk about abusing these virtual worlds. And we might have something like a virtual prime directive or something. You know, you can only observe them, but not change their natural course of evolution.
Well, that's interesting. And would there be restrictions on the number of them that you could build and when you end them?
Well, I think initially the computer simulations are the resources are going to be limited.
Okay.
So you're only going to see that in the Facebooks or the Googles or the server forums. But I could see small simulations being housed in hackerspaces and, you know, contests over that.
And red light districts. Places,
oh, yeah.
You know, that are unregulated, mm-hmm. dark net simulations. That I love this idea that instead of actually writing a script, you create the conditions for a story to play out, and then you go and you document it. I think that's fascinating. What do you think of this, Rob?
I love this idea. I think Norman's onto something. I think quantum computing will allow that level of simulation, but there's a dark side you got to consider here, and that is, when we often say, well, how come we can't predict the weather? And the reason is because we don't have the computing power to consider all the factors that are required to actually do that. What Norman's bringing up in this super, super similar society within a virtual reality is the ability to do just that. The ability to predict things like the weather. And once we have that, once you know exactly what affects the weather, this simulation will be used by governments and well, Google, of course, to affect the weather. They'll be able to do that whole butterfly thing. Well, they'll poke a caterpillar here, and they'll cause rain on their data centers in Tokyo. So, you know, you got to watch out for that dark side.
There might always be
potential for abuse.
Yes.
Yeah. There might always be too much indeterminateness to be able to accurately predict everything, though. Don't you think?
I mean, yes and no, because at its core, once you can quantify everything, and that means you have the computing power to actually run the variables on everything, you should be able to have a hyper-realistic simulation. You know, not just a couple of levels, but magnitudes of levels of, sure. Of simulation.
I guess what I'm thinking, though, is in quantum mechanics, it's all stats. It's all probabilities, right? And so while you can create a simulation that would be very close to the truth... And probably be usable for predicting the weather really well, better than we have now, there'd always be some element of surprise in real life that's going to throw you off.
But, Tom, you are not taking into account the fact that they will develop the Heisenberg Uncertainty Compensator, which will get rid of that last level of uncertainty.
Of course, of course. Brian, what do you think? Are you going to send your documentary crew?
I mean, if especially the fact that you have kind of the ultimate overseer control. So if things get too boring, you can say, all right, well, let's throw Godzilla into the mix. Now, how do these people react? Or let's throw, you know, tornadoes or whatever. I mean, you do have the ultimate control, maybe not necessarily of the AI elements of each of your characters in the documentary, but you've got the elemental control of their surroundings. So you can throw anything you want into the mix to kind of steer them into the direction that will provide the most entertainment and drama.
I guess it's kind of like the Truman Show, the movie, but instead right. of, you know, one person and a real person being the star, it's everyone unwillingly being the star, and you can program as much as you want into their personalities. And I guess initially it would be a crude simulation, much better than what we have now. But like in that movie, The Truman Show, there was a lot of outrage from the public for exploiting these people or this person. I could see that happening with these virtual people.
Oh, yeah. Do we end up with a sim rights movement?
I was going to say, do we end up with one of the sim characters actually figuring out that they're a sim in a simulation and and trying to escape, trying to break out?
But let's get down to it. Who wouldn't watch the show? I mean, especially if you had audience participation, you get to determine what disaster gets thrown into your simulation. Or why not, once we have the computing power, let everyone have their own show, their god of their reality show.
Right. So
press
the star,
one for an alien. Press two for giant robot.
Right. It wouldn't be how good of a filmmaker you are in terms of cinematography. It's how well you program those variables. You know, I have the most unpredictable simulation. You're going to want to watch my channel.
And once we have that, wouldn't it become like every game of sim whatever, where once we've built it up to its pinnacle, we just decide, well, we're going to destroy it now. Plane crash, train crash,
earthquake.
Nuclear explosion, and earthquake.
Yeah. I like this cross-section that we're getting to here between video games and movies, right? Where you could have the processing power, potentially, where every experience of the movie is different, right? Because it's run for you. And you could even get all Strange Days on it and enter the movie, maybe passively, maybe actively, you could pick how much you want to be a part of the actual world you're living in. Would that be something? I mean, what do you think about that, Norm? Do you think directors would say, no, I'm the auteur, I only want this to be consumed, even though it's a documentary? Or would we cross those lines, allow swims and humans to interact?
I think we'd eventually definitely cross those lines. Maybe not the directors themselves, but there are participants who would want to. I mean, you're talking about another magnitude of computational power. But like some variation of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you can't observe them without changing them. So we'd want to go in those virtual worlds.
And I think there is something. I mean, you're bringing back in the humanist side, which is ultimately you want to consume someone else's work. I mean, if you just wanted to create it yourself, you would have it in your imagination. So you do want someone to spell out the narrative for you. And I, in that sense, I'm a traditionalist. I want to see what someone else has set up for me, the story that someone else wants me to see. And like most traditionalists, if I don't like the ending, I'll sue you to change it.
Right, exactly. Mass Effect 3 will no longer have a problem here because you can just change the ending for everyone. It'll all be tailored.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
I think you're right, though. I think sometimes we do want to have a good story told to us. A lot of the time we want that. But then there's also, when we're watching a movie, we want to be in the movie. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily controlling the movie, but we want to be able to experience the movie. And I think what you're suggesting makes that more possible than ever, so that you could actually walk around, you could change the perspective. You're not picking camera angles, you're just looking around.
Yeah. I mean, it could be one world. You could maybe only have enough computing power to simulate one world, and then people buy timeshare inside that world to just observe.
Do I get free luggage if I sit through the demonstration of the timeshare?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, basically, I mean, you download the simulation, and then you get to be in the third reel and get to control whether, you know, Katniss escapes the Hunger Games or Jack and Rose get off the ship before it sinks. I mean, you could potentially be the character that knows what's going to happen and escapes it or averts it.
Is that too much work, though, to be making all those choices? I mean, back to your point.
Are you asking me or Norman? No, I think it'd be fun. Yeah, being able to be within that story that you've watched for three quarters of a season and then get to be in it. I mean, again, you know, it goes to what Father Robert was saying, is that getting to be not necessarily determining the camera angles, but being able to be in that story and kind of helping consume what's going on there. You know, getting to be working at Sterling Cooper Draper Price or whatever and getting to be involved with that. I love that idea.
But I mean, as much as people are attached to their shows now, when someone else is spelling out the narrative for them, how much more attached will they be if they dedicate 10 years of their entertainment experience to building up a world? Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine just from a psychological perspective, when you've actually played God for your citizens, your netizens, your virtual Zens, whatever we're calling them, could you ever let that go?
Quite a bit of responsibility.
Yeah, as long as there's a backup.
That's right. Cause the disasters and then go to the last safe point.
I like versioning. Yeah, versioning solves all of that.
Right.
In fact, I like to feel like that may be what's happening on this planet. It's like, you know, we're always like, wow, how did we avoid like blowing ourselves up in the 60s with nuclear weapons? And we probably did. We just restored to any earlier version. Let's play Cuban Missile Crisis over again. That did not work.
Let's start back over from December, and then we'll see where we go from there. Yeah,
exactly. And hence the premise for Quantum Leap reasserts itself. One last question before we move off of this prediction, though, that I have for you is, the other thing that intrigued me, Norm, was the idea of this being sort of documentary style, right? You create, that's one of the possibilities. You create the world, you let the world play out, and then you go and you document it. But what if they don't cooperate?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, then mm-hmm. it's up to the director to say, hit the reset, change the variables, or go with it. And then it's more like a documentary. I think the unpredictable nature of those simulated worlds is what's interesting. And right now, they're just numbers. But if it's something we can visualize and say, hey, it's a family of people, virtual people, then you just want to see it play out.
Yeah, I think this is a really cool idea, and I like it so much I want it to happen now. So how long do I have to wait?
Can you get on that?
I think 100 years.
100? This is a 100-year prediction.
Yeah,
so we're gonna need some medical advances first.
That's right. I still want to see this in my lifetime. So
yeah. All right, Norm. Any other predictions to throw out before we move off?
No, I'm good. That's
all right. You believe me, you nailed it. So you're not in default. You're not deficient in any way. Father Robert, we'll move it over to you. What do you got for us?
I would actually like to take Norman's prediction. It's much more fun than mine.
There we go. Thanks, everybody, for watching.
I want to start with where I'm going to end up.
Okay.
And then I'll go into how we get there. And that is devices controlled by the mind, which we've done before. I mean, everyone's heard about that. You've got devices that are directly mind-controlled, the whole mind-machine link. But it also is going to be interesting because it's of the process that we take to get there, and also the fact that that mind-machine link will mean the absolute death of anonymity for most of us. So let's go back. And it starts with spectrum, specifically the idea of wireless spectrum. It's the lifeblood of the growth of the technology industry today. Just as the advent of the internet fueled business and commerce 20 years ago, now we've got mobile devices. Everyone wants mobile. Everyone wants to be mobile. Everyone wants to be always connected. But what we're running into, and we've heard this, is the spectrum crunch. There's just not enough bandwidth for all of our devices to connect at the same time. Now, back when wireless was relatively young, there was a lot of spectrum and a relatively few number of devices. It was really easy to sort of amp it up. You just increase the power of your transmitter, you increase the sensitivity of your receiver, and you are good to go. But now with so many devices being added so quickly, you just can't do that anymore, which is why you've got all of these companies petitioning Congress to release more spectrum into the unlicensed frequencies. So my prediction is actually a few parts of that. The first part is you're going to see within 2 to 3 years Congress actually approving an allocation of spectrum into the unlicensed frequencies. They're going to be expanding the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz ranges so that more of these companies can build out their devices. Beyond that, you're going to see a more efficient use of spectrum. This is actually something that I brought a visual aid for. This flying saucer Cylon-looking thing is actually a wireless array. And
it's not a huge Roomba.
It's not. Yeah, this is not a Roomba. This will not clean up your house. But what it will do is allow you to have a really efficient use of your Wi-Fi. If you look inside here, I'm not sure if you can get the shot, this is actually about 36 different radios clustered around a core so that it divides the 360 degrees into multiple slices. This particular array is from a company called Xeris that I've worked with in the enterprise space. And instead of shouting in a room to try to get the attention of devices, it uses lower power with much more directional reach in order to get just that device, which means you could take the same piece of spectrum and divide it into multiple pieces, effectively multiplying the amount of spectrum you have available.
And it tracks it, so if I'm walking around in a circle, it'll just hand it off.
Exactly, so it just hands it off from radio to radio to radio. Now, this is a great piece of tech. You're going to see this from more and more companies in the next, I'd say.
And this is not a home device, right?
Unless you've got a really big home. I mean, this one can serve about 4,000 users. Most of us don't have 4,000 devices. You might.
Is it an enterprise level device or?
This is definitely an enterprise level device, but they've got smaller ones that you know, have four radios. But it's the same idea. It's rather than shouting in a room and having all the devices shouting in the room, why not talk just to the device that you're trying to talk to? That's the more efficient use of spectrum. Now, this gets us a couple of years down the road. So I'd say this will take us from year 3 to about year 6, and then even this will start running out of space. And there will be no more spectrum to allocate. There will be no more ways to filter down the amount of spectrum that each device uses. So what we will start to see is a dedication of spectrum into classes. There'll be carrier waves, which feed devices like these, and then there'll be sort of the personal area network. Think of this shrunken down to the size of a chip that you carry around. Each person has their own carrier wave that they pull all the bandwidth they need for their personal devices. And then that gets broadcasted to their phone, their tablet, their computer. Now, what that also means is you'll have a unique identifier automatically. Your personal area network will identify you and all of your network devices. But it means you'll be able to do things with lower power. It means you'll be able to do things longer. And it means you'll be able to do things faster. Now, moving from, say, 10 to 20 years, what we'll see from this is these will have to get more intelligent. And what better way to make this more intelligent than start integrating it with the man-machine link, actually using the power of your brain to determine where the broadband is being used, which devices are being turned on, and what's communicating at any given time.
You're going to put that in my head?
This will actually go right in your head. It just goes right up top. Now, think of this, but shrunk down a couple of times. And this is what I envision for the future. Now, the first generation is going to be just between the personal area network and your devices, but ultimately, I'd say within 100 years, we get to that point where it's integrated directly into our cerebral cortex, so our devices are our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that concludes this class of enterprise technology.
Thanks for
today.
Bringing that in, by the way. I know on the audio podcast you can't see it.
This is cool.
If somebody wants to look up a picture of it,
yes. Actually,
what would you search for?
You can go to thetechstop.net, and it's actually right there. This is a Xeris Wi-Fi array.
Mm-hmm. And so that would be great for hotels. In fact,
yes,
probably they're already using it.
A great story about something like this. We used to do shows. The Interop is this huge networking conference for enterprise networking people. We did a show in Javits, the Javits Center in New York. And it took us, I won't say the name of the company, but it took us about 106 APs to get okay wireless. I mean, if you've ever been to like South by Southwest or CES, Wi-Fi always falls down. We were able to do it with four of these. And it stayed up the whole time. So this is a much better approach, much more efficient use of spectrum.
I'm suspecting this hotel I stayed at in Montreal is using something like that because they had incredible Wi-Fi.
Right.
That was entirely reliable. And if you're talking about serving hotel rooms where people's their movements are going to be pretty limited, right, by the by the size of the room, that broadcasting directly at that room and says, you know, that works very well. Brian, what do you think?
It's very impressive. I'm wondering if that device you brought in actually is that a functioning
this
unit?
Works.
I mean, is that a wow?
I could turn this on right now and it would power Petaluma.
Let's so, turn it on.
So Twit could so become
now,
an ISP.
So now, compressing that down to the personal area network, do you have security issues you've got to worry about? I mean, does it become more of an issue if you get hacked? All of your devices, all of your whatever you're using is potentially at risk, right? Is that the only real concern is that security
and
for your chip, for your head chip.
There are actually some very smart students at Stanford right now who have figured out a brilliant way to work around that. They're creating a protocol called OpenFlow, which is sort of a network management protocol, which you don't have to know what it means, but essentially it identifies you. No matter what you connect to, what device you're coming through, what port, what switch, what access point, you're coming in through your 4G network, you're coming through your Wi-Fi network, it knows it's you, and it hands you off from place to place to place. So there's no way for someone to get in there and start spoofing your identity.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's 10 years down the line.
Wow. No, I love it. I mean, you think about all those diagrams that you see of the cloud, and then it goes out to the computers, and then the computers go to the users. This goes from the cloud to the users to everything around them, to their computers, their iDevices, their Androids, their whatever. I love that idea.
And you know, we've got this. The guys on All About Android talk about this all the time, which is the unfairness of having your iPhone or having your iPad and paying two different data subscription ones when you're using the same data. So why wouldn't you just have one device, ultra-fast device, that gets that big, big pipe to you, and then you distribute it to the devices you want to use?
Because the carriers need a charging model.
Yes, they do.
They need to know how much you'll pay for that. Norm, what do you think of this?
I like the idea. I like the idea of this personal area network. It's like having your own area code because you ran out of phone numbers. Except for Spectrum. I'm curious, why do you need that cybernetic connection? Why does it need to be controlled by the brain? I can barely multitask four things at once. How am I going to handle 1,000 different signals from one pipe?
Good point. And that was the sort of the 20 to 30 year time frame. And that's because these personal area networks are going to need to get more intelligent. If you've got that one source of data, you need to know which devices you're directing it to, which devices are connecting. And again, this is part of the security. You don't want rogue devices connecting to your personal area network. So the first generation of those devices will just have that built into the software. But the next logical step, as we improve the man-machine link, is to say, look, why don't I just use some of the power of my brain? When I need to make a phone call, it automatically turns on my phone and directs bandwidth to my phone. When I want to use my computer, it automatically does the same to my laptop or my tablet. If I want to use my augmented reality glasses, I don't have to think, okay, I have to turn on the glasses, I have to set them up, it just sort of does everything for you.
Well, I'm imagining the abuse because I like the angle of abusing this technology, and I could see a total black market of people selling their connectors, maybe brains, for hackers to, like, instead of spoofing an IP address, you spoof that person's personal area network because you have access to his brain.
Absolutely. And that's why I said the death of anonymity for most of us. There's always going to be those people who are going to find out how to game the system, how to hack the system. And yeah, if you start taking someone else's personal area network code, whatever that might be, there's a lot of potential for abuse, especially if it gets to the point where we feel so secure that we just assume something happening on that network is that person doing it. So his financial records, his medical records, his whatever that he's trying to hide.
Now, I don't think this solves that problem, but a different take on what you're talking about is the idea of mesh networking. And it's not necessarily incompatible with this. In fact, this could play right into it. But instead of having the centralized ISP, instead of receiving the signal from the central office into your, whether it's a personal area network you're carrying in your pocket or if it eventually ends up your head, it really doesn't matter. But instead of that, we actually share our bandwidth with each other. Mm-hmm. So, and we're passing around the packets based on how many people are around. The only time that becomes a problem is if you're out away from people, and or if you're in, you know, a community that doesn't believe in the personal area network and no one has one on.
Exactly.
But for most cities and most settled areas on the planet, you could get around the bandwidth problem by just sharing the bandwidth person to person.
Exactly. And actually, this does mesh. I mean, remember mesh was so big 10 years ago until people realized it's not really going to work the way we thought it was going to. We actually do this. When we set these up in these conference centers, we mesh all of the access points together until we can actually get out there with a physical cable. So that's how we drive all those devices. Now, we will never have enough bandwidth to connect every single mobile device directly back to our telco. So that, yes, absolutely. What you're talking about is perfect, which is you've got that one central connection that then distributes to the smaller devices. So you're not always overloading that main whatever.
Can we get rid of the central connection?
You could. Now, that's actually an interesting question, because if the main positive from the internet and the connected society is access to information, well, if I have access to the information of the people around me and they have access to the information of the people around them, technically, I don't need any centralized connection. I could just keep hopping and hopping and hopping until I find what I need.
Yeah, and that's the way the internet works.
Right.
The internet's already
right.
built to do that. So the idea of saying, look, we don't need to worry about net neutrality. We don't need to worry about the bandwidth crunch. A lot of people are saying if we have mesh networks, and in fact, they're out there trying to deploy them in places like Syria, Egypt, during protests where the internet gets either compromised or shut down, gets around all of that. Norm, does this sound plausible to you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think this idea of the benefit of having dense communities, dense populations for improved mesh networks is really interesting. It's like the opposite of the old DSL cable. It's like, oh, now that you have more neighbors, it's actually better. And they're on the internet all the time.
It's the opposite of downtown San Francisco, too.
Yeah.
With your wireless devices. But so you think mesh is something that could end up paying off?
Yes, I'm just not sure that the bureaucracy, we're never going to get past that.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that we have the internet, considering that if that had been proposed, actually I've read some things that it was proposed to AT&T, and they said, no, we're not going to do that. That's crazy. So we kind of needed the 1960s mentality of the moonshot and the let's spend some money on public projects without really being sure that they'll pay off. And we're kind of in the opposite of that. But the question is, we've developed so many things on the internet because of the platform that exists already that don't need that kind of centralization. Brian, do you think we can get there again? Do you think we can do some jazz, some internet jazz, and make these sorts of things a reality?
Sure. And I'm visualizing what this does to public computing. For example, you go to a library, you go to, you know, any sort of public place, and maybe they've got tablets and they've got laptops that you can check out. Because it's your personal network, you get this public laptop or you get this public tablet, and you already have access to your stuff already. So, you know, you've got basically the connection to all of your stuff that you need, because it's recognizing your personal network. It's really, I don't know, it's a really cool idea.
And you can tie together the two predictions. If we have that hyper-realistic quantum computing simulation and we're all connected together, we could all be sharing our versions of the simulation, creating a whole new avenue for user-generated content.
And we're in the metaverse.
That's yeah. right.
Exactly.
You like that version of the documentary. You should see my version of the documentary.
It's a new version of, would you like to hear my poetry?
Right.
Right. No, I would not like to see your documentary. Thank you. Your simcumentary. I really am attached to this idea of mesh network and this sort of thing, you know, making it more possible. I think you're right about the bureaucracy, Norm, but I think what happens is someone somewhere down the line is eventually going to push things too far. And we've seen them push it way too far in Egypt when they turn off the internet, right? And that's what causes people to suddenly bring suitcases around and start setting up their own networks. Eventually, some company or some service pushes it too far, SOPA style, and the internet citizens rise up and say, fine, well, we'll build our own internet. But it's going to take a big... I mean, you saw how much had to happen before the internet finally rose up and protested against SOPA. it's going to take a lot to get people to, you know, turn off their Nyan Cats for a while and get out on the streets. What would do that?
I mean, what would allow us to shut that down?
Yeah, what's the kind of thing that would push people that far where they're like, fine, we're motivated now?
Well, you know, I think we're already there. We've got case after case of the telco stepping in and saying, we will not run fiber to your town, but we don't want you running it either.
Right.
And I think we're getting to that point where we're realizing that connectivity to the wider network. I'm not saying the internet. I'm saying the wider network because it actually goes beyond the internet. That's not so much an option anymore. It's more of a right. If you want to participate in society, you need that. You can't. I mean, we can almost not go into what do they used to call it in Ghost in the Shell, into autistic mode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about how many times do you absolutely need your phone or your tablet to come up with that answer that you just can't come up with off the tip of your brain? Well, if you shut that down, people go into withdrawals. I mean, they've actually documented when they start looking at internet addiction, what happens when people lose the connection to the information, and it's like a drug user going off cocaine. There's a whole area of the brain that just sort of shuts down. Well, nothing drives people to action more quickly than feeling like that. They need it. They realize, no, we can't trust you anymore, so we need to take matters into our own hand to get ourselves back connected.
What do you think, Norm? Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, that or having so many devices that we would need that much spectrum and having separate data plans for each. If they're going to charge me for text messages and, you know, for my glasses and phone and tablet and whatever I might have, if I'm having potentially 1,000 devices connected to a personal area network, I want to pay only one plan for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Brian, what about you?
I'm going along that same sort of thing. I mean, you get an AT&T bill that is for Bill. Not an AT&T bill for your iPad, your iPhone. It costs $600 to run Bill this month.
Yeah. Bill is what you're going to call your personal area network?
That's right, yes.
I like it. It's snappy.
Hello, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. Have you been able to connect to Bill? I'll share Bill with you if you'd like.
I'm sorry, Bill. You realize I can't allow you to do that.
I can't do that, Bill.
What's Bill's subnet?
Who's Lynn?
You've hit your bandwidth cap, Bill. All right. Let's move on into the four question land. Brian Ibbett, do you know about the four questions? You're going to be delivering the four questions.
I've heard of this thing. I was on the other side of it, but I've heard of this and I'm ready for it.
Okay. Four questions is the segment where each of our guests face four questions about the future. And they are not allowed, or they're asked not to. We can't really stop them. But you're asked not to stop and think.
I'll stop them.
Just to answer.
I'll stop them.
It's kind of hard to stop them from not thinking.
I do that all the time.
Too many negatives. Answer with whatever comes to mind. Kind of a free association time. So, Brian, you're asking Norm. Shoot four questions.
Sounds good. Norm, question number one. Assuming that you don't have access to a DeLorean, what current piece of technology would you most like to install a flux capacitor into? And what boost would it provide?
Oh, my goodness. Washing machine.
Okay, and what boost would it provide for you?
What boost? Like what extra ability add to the...
What a benefit over the current washing machine technology would the flux capacitor provide for you?
It would be the washer and the dryer, obviously.
Ah,
and it's my washing machine sings me a song right now already, so it's pretty futuristic. Yeah.
Living in the future over there. Yeah. Hmm.
All right. Question number two, you're in jail, and I'm not going to go into the specific reasons for how you got there or what you did, but you get one phone call, and you can only use it to call either Jamie Hyneman or Adam Savage. Who do you call?
I call Jamie, because he would build a robot to break me out.
Ah, there you go.
Good call.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. I know you're into Lego.
Mm-hmm.
Best Lego brick, the 6x2 or the hinge?
6x2.
Good.
Easier to find.
Yeah, I wouldn't have accepted Hinge, so very good. And I also know that you're a comic book fan. What comic series would you refuse ever to buy only on a tablet? In other words, you need to have the physical comic copy of it, and you won't settle for a pixel version of it.
Oh, I would not buy Sandman. I want that in the tome, the absolute version.
Very good. The Neil Gaiman, nice.
Yes. Yeah, good call. All right.
Good choice. Excellent.
Those are your four questions. How do you feel?
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah, good job. Right, nicely done. Father Robert, it's your turn. Are you sitting comfortably?
No.
Good, then we'll begin.
That's the way we like it.
Question number one, how close are we to the Bene Gesserit from Dune becoming real?
You don't realize that we already have that. My religious order is actually just a bunch of shriveled up old women with bald heads masquerading as men like myself.
So we're there.
We are there, and we've got the water of life.
No ships?
No ships, no ships.
Everything? Yes. All right.
That's why you can't see us.
You heard it here first. I can't see you right now. That explains it. Question number two. Will the iPad become a generic term for all tablets?
It will not become a generic term for all tablets, but it will become a generic term for all technology. Everything will just be an iPad.
Could like Taco Bell becomes all restaurants?
Exactly. Could you pass me the iPad that starts the car? You know, yeah. It's going to be stuff like that.
this thing in your head, iPad.
This
I've
is
got
an
some
iPad
in
array.
My head.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. All right, I got it. Question number three. What will moon-farmed cheese taste like?
It will taste surprisingly like cheese farmed at the bottom of the ocean. It's going to be very sort of airy and light and kill you.
Kill you. So it won't sell very well.
No.
Not to be used internally.
It's to be given to your worst enemies.
Ah.
And enjoyed as you watch them well do their thing.
Hence the name deadly as moon cheese.
Absolutely.
The old phrase.
I say that all the time.
That people say. Why is it going to taste the same as ocean cheese?
Well, because when you start looking at
that's not one of the four questions. I'm just curious.
They're absolutely diametrically opposed, which is, you know, naturally they would be the
they
same.
End up giving you the
that's
same.
Right.
Okay,
that's
good.
Right. It's going around all the way and coming back to the same point.
Excellent. And question number four, will ISPs become more powerful or will something like mesh networks wrest control from them? I wrote this up this morning at 11 a.m.
We're in sync. ISPs will become more powerful until mesh networks wrest control away from them, and then they will find a way to regain control because they'll offer a brand new spanking feature like the latest whatever that you can only get on their network.
So it's an eternal battle.
It is an eternal battle.
They will just constantly at each other, locked in the battle for it. Well done. Your four questions are over.
Oh, fantastic.
And you did great. Thank you both for being on Forecast. Really appreciate you taking the time, especially coming in and Skyping in and spending some time sharing your visions of the future with us. Norman Chan, you can find at tested.com. What's going on over there? Anything special coming up you want to tell folks about?
We're heading to Vegas for the NAB conference.
Ah, fun.
Nice.
And then going to Portland immediately after for the SCAA. It's a specialty coffee show. And we'll have a lot of fun there. So expect a lot of videos from that.
Okay. Well, for people who don't know, the NAB is National Association of Broadcasters. I can see what kinds of things you might do there. What are you going to be doing at the coffee convention?
We're also really big coffee geeks. Me and the other guy who runs Tested, Will Smith, we love coffee. We went last year, and they have coffee competitions. You'll find the most advanced coffee machines in the world. And it's quite something. If you enjoy a good cup of coffee or enjoy making a cup of coffee, it's something to pay attention to.
I'm a huge fan of coffee myself, and I'm always enjoying trying these, you know, like the plunger or the what's the one that's supposed to make the perfect cup of coffee? Kind of looks like a carafe.
The AeroPress?
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're talking about the
No, the AeroPress is the plunger one, but the
yes. The Chemex.
The Chemex, yeah.
The Chemex with the cone, metal filter, and then you also need a Japanese kettle.
Is this the kind of place where we'll find out what the next Chemex is?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, keep an eye on it, folks. Tested.com. For NAB, you know, if you want to find out the latest broadcasting technology, but especially for the coffee. Come for the NAB. Stay for the coffee. And Father Robert Ballester, the techstop.net. Obviously, great stuff going on over there. Anything new, cool, special coming up you want to tell folks about?
Well, actually, the last time I was on TNT, I was telling people about the industrial strength shredder that was coming in, and it came in and it shredded itself. So we're recovering from that.
That's like a snake eating its own tail,
yeah,
sort of thing.
It was very strange. Very loud. Very, very surprisingly loud enough to get the DC police out to our house.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm not doing that again.
Shredders in DC, they've got a long history, so
exactly.
They're a little weird about that kind of stuff.
Well, there are actually shredder trucks that go around the streets of DC, and businessmen run after them like kids after an ice cream truck. It's fantastic. I'll tip it one day.
Please take my evidence now. But you're always got new stuff at the tech stop.
Absolutely. There's always new stuff. There's always new reviews. There's always little tips and tales about our travels, the geek family of the Ballesters. And it's just a really good place to find out what's going on in geekness.
That's the tech stop, thetechstop.net. And Brian Ibbett, thank you so much for filling in for Scott Johnson.
My pleasure. It's been an honor. I appreciate you inviting me to be on here.
Always a pleasure. I've been a huge fan of Coverville since, like, I lived in five different places ago in 2005 when my wife introduced me to it. So tell folks about Coverville, but anything else you got going on you want to...
Yes. Oh, look, there's my website right there. Yes. So Coverville.com, it's a podcast and syndicated radio show devoted to cover songs. Just did a show recently for the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Rolling Stones. They started 50 years ago this month. Also, Sgt. Pepper's recently, Sgt. Pepper's show, things like that. So if you like cover songs, actually, if you like music, try it out. Don't be scared by the fact that cover songs sometimes are seen as the last great idea that a rock band has. Think of it as more of the inspiration and the homage to the people that inspired them. You can also find me over at The Morning Stream, over there at frogpants.com and FilmSack. And you can follow me like a businessman running after a shredder truck at Coverville on Twitter and Facebook.com/Coverville.
All right, Scott Johnson will be back with us. We will not have a forecast episode next week because of NAB, because we've got so much programming covering NAB here on the Twit Network, but we will be back in 2 weeks with an all-new episode. Scott and I are doing a show called Autopilot on the Frog Pants Network. Check out autopilotshow.com. We just review a different pilot of a television show every week. I believe Stargate SG-1 is the one we're doing this week, so you can check that out if you're missing Scott and me together. That's another place you can find us. And of course, you can find us on the web right here at twit.tv/FC, or our blog is forecastpodcast.com. And send us an email. Our email address is forecast@twit.tv. The old Gmail address still works, but we've got a new official Twit address, forecast@twit.tv. That's it for this episode of Forecast. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. We'll see you next time. And that's the show. Thanks, you guys.
Oh, very good.
That was fun.
Oh, thanks for
having me. That was fun.
Yeah, that was great. Visual aids.
Yeah, visual aids, and we have cinematic things
really
in my
impressive.
Head.
Sim documentary.
Cylon headpieces. And
yeah.
This does kind of look like a Roomba. It really does.
Although in one of the shots, right there, I keep thinking it's like a salad bowl because of the green.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or a zoetrope. You can spin it around, see an animation.
Yeah. Right.
You'll see exactly. The documentary that I shot with my Sims.
But only in 5 frames per second.
Right. It's actually just a horse.
I go by Brian.
I was going to introduce you as Brian. Is that okay?
That's okay, yes.
Is that really a Pepsi jersey?
It is really a Pepsi jersey. I don't remember how many points it took to get this. I'm sure it was at least a case of cans. Yeah, I'm sure.